Welcome to the podcast. Who are you and what are you drinking, Nathan?
I'm Nathan Sanders, and I'm drinking a mug of Earl Grey tea in my favorite mug from the Massachusetts State House.
That is a great thing. Why Earl Grey? Why do you prefer Earl Grey to just a straight black tea?
Well, good question. I guess there's a little more flavor. I like the bergamot flavor.
Have you tried Lady Grey?
I'm sure that I have. I couldn't give you a good reason why I don't prefer it, though.
So it's slightly less common and slightly more floral, but I do like a Lady Grey. I think that was my sad teenage studying drink of choice, but with like 3 spoonfuls of brown sugar. So it was it was like treating yourself for shock, but the shock was being in high school.
I could still probably use that. That'll be my homework. I'll pick up some Lady Grey tea.
And Bruce Schneier, what are you drinking?
So I am drinking it. If it was morning here, I would be drinking Darjeeling. But what this is an herbal tea from the Chartreusean monks in France that make chartreuse. They also take some of their botanicals and make a tea. This is Angelus de Soir. They actually have four different ones, and this is a nighttime tea. And if you like open it up, it's like a box of twigs and leaves, and it's quite delicious.
I am drinking hojicha, which is also a box of twigs and leaves, and mine is from Art Tea, an art tea place, organic hojicha. And I'm running out because it's closed down. I moved to Queensland, and where I moved, there's a tea shop across the road that like won prizes, and I was like, this is the perfect place for me, but it's shut down. So I bought up all of their stock. Why did you go with the Chartreusean monks for your herbal tea of choice? Did you figure monks knew a lot about relaxation, or?
I like chartreuse, the alcohol. And a couple of years ago, we visited the distillery. You can actually tour the old distillery in south of France, and they sell these teas. So we bought them, and this is my standard evening tea until I run out, because you can only get it at the monastery, which is like hard to get to.
The monastery's not online. You have to do a pilgrimage for the tea. All of this is right up my alley. I'm really into this now. Excellent. I'm delighted. What have the pair of you, or individually, what have you been wrestling with of late? What's been going around in your heads?
Well, we have a new book that's coming out in just a few weeks called Rewiring Democracy that Bruce and I have been working on together. Love that you have the prop there. Fantastic. It
Perfect.
represents a big part of the last year or so of our lives, but also reflects on work that we've done together for years going before that. And I'll try and answer your question directly in terms of what I'm wrestling with right now, which is the political dynamics that we have in the United States right now, which presents so many challenges. And with respect to our book, which is all about the many ways that AI already is impacting democratic processes here and around the world, and about how that changes in the future, I'm really thinking a lot about how AI changes this current political moment, the current political dynamics in the United States, what it means for each of our two warring political parties to adopt a new technology in the midst of this chaos in the United States, and where things go from there.
And what he means by thinking about it now is like what we are writing literally today is thinking about how these systems will affect, politics this year and next year. More generally, we're thinking about all the different ways around the world that AI is affecting democracy, largely looking at the good things, the ways it is making democracy more democratic. It's easy to talk about the problems, and we do, but it's also good to highlight how this is going to help.
Well, yes, I feel like I'm in the arts scene. By the way, I should hook you up with my twin brother. He's an academic in the ethics of AI, so I feel like I really everything you say, I'm like, I should call Henry into this podcast, but he's outside minding the children, so I can't. Yes, I feel like in the arts, which is where I am, there is a lot of extreme fear and negativity about AI for good reason. It is built on stolen land, and people are very worried that the people who have money to fund the arts are hoping to mainly fund like one artist wrangling a team of AI instead of 15 writers for a project. Or I feel slightly less decided on my opinion on AI. I don't think I have an opinion yet, other than that I know that it's coming and that the main impact it will have on most people's everyday life is just more, oh my God, am I talking to a person? Like, is this a person who's calling me on the phone or emailing me? Or like, I feel like that is going to be the main kind of friction maybe, or the thing that we'll be wading through. And so I'm focusing more in my business on being in a room with people, the ways in which I can, run my writers' meetings or my writers' retreats, where it's just being in a room with human beings is now, at least for me, increasingly valuable part of my business. But for you guys, what are the positives about the democracy AI thing?
Before we do that, I want to talk about some things you said. So, chatbots and drawing programs are a small piece of AI. When we think of AI and democracy, we think of AI, including the AI that is your mapping software on your phone, which is AI-based and is not a chatbot. There's a lot to AI that isn't chatbots, that isn't artists,
Well, this is
that,
extraordinary medical technology that I think is going to be
right, and
amazing.
the AI system that basically won a Nobel Prize this year was not a chatbot. Now, I think of it as AI being the fruit of the poison tree. And because it was built on copyrighted work, nothing good could come of it. You know, I mean, the copyrighted work is we're going to work through that. We have to. And even so, there is going to be good out of it. There's going to be a lot of slop, and we're seeing lots of slop. But, you know, be careful about generalizing. And also, things are changing so fast. And then I'll sort of pass to Nate to talk about some of the democratic things that are interesting.
Yeah, I really appreciate that you're inviting us to call out some of the positive opportunities with AI. I think I'd love to just put two things on the table. One, when it comes to democracy, I think there's an enormous amount of value to what you described, Alice, of getting people in the room. The deliberative part of democracy is really core to how our form of government is supposed to work. Not only hopefully getting the right outcomes that are in the best interest of the population, not only having outcomes that are fair, but including people in the deliberative process to get towards those outcomes. That's core to democracy. And one of the challenges that the collective we as a collection of societies across the world have faced in recent years is that as populations have grown, as the scale of democracies has grown, I mean, look at India, more than 1 billion people participating in democracy, getting people in the proverbial room is just no longer feasible. And so for generations, we've found ways to leverage technology to bring people into the conversation. I think you can look at a continuum from telegrams to radio to television to the internet and now to AI as technological ways to incorporate more people, more points of view into the deliberative process. I think AI has the potential to be a transformative technology for improving the scale of those deliberations. We write in our book about, I think, probably dozens of examples of civic technology groups and governments around the world that are leveraging AI to hold simultaneous conversations with hundreds or thousands, or in some cases, hundreds of thousands of people, where everyone can not only fill out a survey or check a box on a ballot, but actually give a substantive opinion that's incorporated and synthesized into a point of view that can be put in front of policymakers and should, I think, increasingly drive legislative outcomes. For a lot of my work in Massachusetts, it's focused on exactly that, trying to leverage those types of technologies to make our democracy better. The second thing I'd love to put on the table is that I think you're absolutely right that a lot of AI today is developed. I like the expression used on stolen land. I think in both figurative and literal terms, that's right. Especially with the concentration of the development happening in the US. But it doesn't have to be that way. There's nothing about this technology that inherently requires the theft of data or content to develop the technology. We write in our book about an alternative vision for how AI is made, in addition to how it's used, an alternative way that it can be made that is more respectful of people's rights and compensates people for their work and is really driven by a public development process instead of a private one. We talk about the concept of public AI, which some governments around the world, including places like Singapore and Switzerland, have invested in, where the government, under public control and oversight, gathers data in a responsible way, leverages technologies that are often innovated in other places, applies them to train models, and then provides them as a public good that's not just for private companies to capture profit, but is available to governments to use for public administrative use cases and can benefit private sector actors as well.
Yeah, I think I use stolen land for a number of reasons, because I think it encapsulates part of my conflicting feelings about AI as the new territory, which is, first of all, if you can't pay for the raw materials from which you make your product, you have either a colonial project or a crime. You don't have a business. But also, if this is the land we're working with, you know, we are all living on stolen land, particularly here in Australia, but all over the world. And, you know, I am not going to say I'll leave here. I'm not in that position of going back to where I came from, because I came from a whole lot of different places, and all of that sort of complexity is part of how I'm thinking about AI. If this is the thing that we are going to be using as artists, and again, it's one thing to generate a picture or a piece of text from AI, which I feel like will get better, but at the moment is very, very obvious to me as both a reader and a viewer. It's got that sort of odd slickness and odd genericness to it that is very marked. But also things like, if I want to make a home movie and I can't pay to get it color graded by 10 or 15 people frame by frame, the AI would let me do that. And that is a democratization of access to quality of work or kinds of work that otherwise you would have to, again, either have a lot of money, access to gatekeepers and willingness, you know, be a Nepo baby or whatever it happens to be, or make lots of friends and be able to convince them at a stage of your lives where you all have lots of time to spare that they can do the color grading for you and you'll swap some labor for them and have that. That is also a luxury. You know, people say, oh, you can make a movie for no money. You just got to get a bunch of friends together and do it. And you go, okay, so none of your friends can have children or full-time jobs, or these things are more complicated than they appear on the surface. And I think, but at the same time, I think if people are not being paid for their work, the only people who will be doing art are wealthy amateurs and people being paid by corporate interests or the government. And that, I think, is a loss as well. So that is all a lot to kind of throw at you, but gives you, I think, the very broad outlines of how AI is emerging to me as a picture for artists. And again, I'm sort of, as a matter of principle, refusing to have an opinion on it yet. Because I resent the pressure to have an opinion on things immediately. But you, for democracy as something that gives people access, this feels like synthesizing a lot of voices into one. What are the risks there?
Well, we already synthesize a lot of voices into one decision, who wins and who loses. Mm-hmm. So already we have the worst possible outcome. Everyone has an opinion and there's one bit of information at the end. If we can get a sentence instead of just one bit, we're doing great. If we get a paragraph, that's fantastic. So lots of risks, but remember where we are today. And a lot of, I actually get what you're talking about artists. We can extend that to other professions as well. I mean, any of the apprentice professions, like lawyer or accountant or architect, where the senior people become senior by entry level and working their way up, if the bottom rung is done by AIs, again, forget chatbots, these would be, you know, other types of AIs, then you just don't have that kind of career path. So we have to worry about the future of work in a lot of professions. We've done this before, and there are sort of two competing schools of thought here. One is, over the course of civilization, we've had many of these revolutions, the Industrial Revolution, where lots of jobs disappear and new jobs appear. If this is like that, this will be complicated and there'll be winners and losers. We'll get through it. But if this one is different, if in fact, you know, jobs disappear and no new jobs appear, then we need to figure out, you know, how people support themselves. And we've built society around employment, even more in the United States than in other countries, because, you know, healthcare and your safety net is based on employment. How do you do that? And we don't know yet.
Yes, I sort of have always shied away from utopian ideals that end up with nobody working, because I take great pleasure in work. And for me, for example, art the aesthetic product at the end is like a flag that's been put up at the top of the mountain. I value the work. If you've dropped a flag at the top of the mountain with a helicopter, it doesn't mean as much to me. I'm not that interested in it. This is my own aesthetic preference, I guess. And I love work. I enjoy solving problems, and that kind of application of creative thinking is like the point of my life. I know that there are a lot of people who do work that is not pleasurable or pleasant or enjoyable or interesting to them. And so, yeah, where we value work and what value we put on the process of work, both for the worker and for the product, I think we're going to have, I think there'll be a breakdown, really, of industries in which all we are interested in is the final product, in which case AI will be super useful, and industries in which the work is part of what we value about it. The work of art is what's interesting to me, I think. Nathan, what do you think about work? Do you want to live on a beachside resort lying back, or do you want to work hard?
Well, of course, I'd like to have both experiences scattered throughout my life. I'm sure everyone would.
That was a trick question. I'm sorry.
What you say definitely resonates with me. I mean, it makes me think of a conversation Bruce and I had while we were writing the book. And as this technology was getting better and better, and as we were finding ways to use it in different aspects of our work, we faced a question: is it appropriate? Would we use it as part of writing our book? And we decided no, in large part, and Bruce, I'll speak for myself at least, and you can jump in with your opinion, in large part because the reason we work together, the reason we do this work is that we enjoy writing. The process of writing is how we think through the ideas that we want to share. And even if we could potentially get to a similar endpoint using another tool, we wouldn't want to do it because we're engaged in this process. Like you said, the work is a little bit the endpoint itself. The only other thing I'd add to that is that I value the technology and its advancement in part because it helps expand the range of work that I'm able to do. I'll give you two small examples. One, a lot of my work is data science and programming. There are certain languages I know well and work in every day, like Python. There are other languages I have no training in. And previously, there's a whole category of software development, programming, data science that was sort of off limits to me. I just didn't have the skill set. But these, you know, AI coding assistants today are so incredibly effective that it's wildly increased the range of work that I'm capable of doing. And for a lot of my colleagues, I know they feel the same way. I'm sure outside of software development and data science, there are lots of examples of that. The other example I was going to give is I don't have a lot of artistic skill. I don't think I do. I don't have visual illustrative skill, certainly. And so I really value being able to express my the pictures in my mind using AI image generators. And I use that to illustrate the talks that Bruce and I give together about our book, et cetera. It's a capability I wouldn't have had otherwise. I think it expands the range of work that I'm able to do and that I enjoy.
That makes me feel a lot of feelings. Bruce, what are your thoughts?
When you talked about this notion of the process mattering, I thought about democracy. Because one of the hypotheticals we talk about in our book, we can imagine an AI that knows my preferences and votes for me. We can imagine AI that knows everybody's preferences and just says, I did the election in my computing brain, and this is the outcome. This is what the tax policy should be. This is what the immigration policy should be. This is what the environmental policy should be. And we could think about that. But to us, the value of democracy is not just getting at the answer. The process of humans doing democracy is essential to democracy. So even if the AI is somehow better than the messiness of human democracy, it isn't what we want. What we would have would not be a democracy. That the process matters equally as much as the result. And I think that's a very important thing to think about when you think about where it makes sense to use these tools. And also, as Nathan pointed out, where these tools assist us and make us more capable, and where they replace us and, in a sense, make us more helpless.
So I will give two examples. I think, for example, my tax form now mostly populates itself. I can say my bank account details, I can give them access to things, and I don't have to do my taxes, which gives me, let's say, a week of time in which I can be doing the creative work that I want to be doing. That is amazing. That's incredible for me, because that is work that no one else can do but me or an AI. Or paying an accountant, I guess.
Other people are more creative on their taxes. I think that's your problem.
That is probably my problem. But get, yeah, it's sort of slogging through all of these receipts. If I just take photos of them and I put them in a folder, I can get an AI to summarize them and put them in an Excel spreadsheet. Like all of those things that would take my mental energy. To me, that's really appealing as a use potentially for this kind of AI technology. Again, environmental stuff impact aside. And then on the other hand, I think about the creative work. And Nathan, you pointing out that you can get pictures, but you don't have artistic skill. That really fires me up because I think we have a wrong idea about what a creative genius is. Like you think of a creative genius as someone who has a vision of the artwork that they want to end up with and then executes that vision perfectly. But actually, a creative genius is somebody who has a vision and doesn't have the resources or the skills or that, you know, in Jaws. The reason that Jaws is such an amazing movie is because the shark didn't work. The shark broke down all the time and they'd set up the filming and they had the hours and they had the staff there and they were leaking money and they had to make something, but the shark wasn't working. So they had to work around the shark not working, and that makes it a much better movie than if he'd been able to sit down and go, I would like a scary shark, please. And a scary shark had been delivered on a platter. But actually, you know, working with whatever it is, the materials that you can afford or the color, you had this vision of a perfect golden color, but you don't. You've got yellow and orange, and so you have to figure out how to give the illusion of gold with the yellow and orange and white and the way that the light falls and the other colors that you use. That creative problem-solving process is not just justified by the end result of the art, but is the point of the work of the art, I think. That kind of the back and forth, which I think is analogous to the democratic process. Because if my preferences were taken into account and I was given everything that I preferred, I have a 3-year-old. If she was given everything that she wanted, life would be hell for her and for everyone around her. Part of the process of being people in a society is having those preferences challenged and complexified. And actually, maybe this thing that you've never encountered before, this idea that you've never heard of before, might be better. Or you have this idea of what the outcome will be, and it's much different, or it's much more complicated than you thought it would be. Like, all of that process is, I think, the point. I'm excited to see how you guys bring these ideas forward. Are you in conversation with a lot of people, or is it just you two in a room?
Yeah, there's a lot of people thinking about AI and ethics, AI and democracy, AI and the future of work, AI and everything. There's a cacophony of people thinking about it. We are both involved peripherally in, Nathan met and mentioned, the public AI movement, right? AI that is not corporate based. And I do some work in reimagining democracy. I do computer security, so I talk to computer security people. So there's a lot of people talking and writing about this, so we are just one voice of many.
I'm sure not many of your listeners are here in Massachusetts, but if they happen to be, we've got a great gathering of our community that's happening in just about a week here on October 1st. We have an event at the Massachusetts State House that's gathering civic technologists from across our state. I think Massachusetts is a really remarkable place because of our academic community, because of the long history of our democracy within the American context, you know, here in Massachusetts, dating back before the American Revolution. And so we're going to have an event really putting a spotlight on that, talking about all these civic organizations, not governments, not companies, but civic, largely often volunteer nonprofit organizations who are coming together to try and solve problems for democracy with technology. And I'm really looking forward to that. And you're asking that question just reminds me how great it is to be a part of that community because there's so much innovation happening right now.
And I want to mention one thing that you, Alice, said before. You talked about, you in passing, the environmental cost. That could change. And right now, it's crazy dumb expensive to train and run these models. It is getting cheaper. It is getting cheaper fast. And we don't know in a couple of years if you're going to be able to run a model on your phone. And in some ways, this is similar to the way search went down in price from when it first started to now. It could be that these become more expensive, but my guess is they're becoming cheaper. And I think that would be good for the world. And I like the notion of distributing it. If it's in the hands of a few tech oligarchs, that's not good for society. If everybody's running their own model on their phones, that's great.
Yes, I think Well, again, you know, speaking of the ethics of phones, we've all got deeply problematic devices in our pockets. But yes, as far as I can tell, the people who are AI boosters or believers or the people who are very involved in AI seem to be suggesting that it is overwhelmingly likely that it will become less costly to the environment and financially. And I think
AI is getting the opposite, I think. They're still pouring money into these massive models. We'll see what happens.
We will see what happens. There are people, I mean, everyone, the people who are pro or against, we're all taking the bet, whether we have agreed to it or not. We're all taking the bet that this will start to produce good outcomes for the world before it eats the world, before it eats all of the water, before it takes all the electricity, before it absolutely destroys the landscape of both online and the actual landscape. That is a gamble that is being made on our behalf, and I think a lot of the people who are extremely against AI resent that gamble being made. You know, they didn't consent to that bargain. It is a bargain that is being made by, you know, 150 mostly men in rooms somewhere, with, you know, cascading downward effects. And I think
you've got white American men.
Yes.
Who live in California? It's worse than you think.
It's a very specific class of people who get to make that decision for everyone. And I think most of the people who I know who are absolutely anti, smash it all, burn it all down, are mainly driven by resentment of that. That even if it does turn around and get cheaper, they shouldn't have had that right to gamble all of our lives and all of our well-being. And that, I think, is a more fundamental issue with the way things are run. It's just that AI is the perfect kind of case study for how it gets done. But let's all keep our fingers crossed. I hope that they are right. I hope that it turns around and that the incredible, like the hearing aid technology that's coming in with AI, that they can do live translations, and that if you have a hearing impairment, you can say, what did that person just say? And it can play it back to you. The access of those Meta glasses, you can, if you are visually impaired, you can say, what am I looking at? And it will read the sign to you. These things are
colorblind. It could
incredible.
That is, yeah.
Life-changing.
As a tech, this stuff is pretty cool.
Yeah, these things are amazing. And I don't want to ignore the capacity of them just because I'm upset about the environmental cost. I'd like to be fair-minded as I make my mind up about it. But as yet, I really haven't, and I'm sure I'm going to get a lot of emails about it. Before I wrap up and ask you to plug your book again, would you like to, my audience, they're very lovely, they're very kind, and they're all thinking. They're all thinking people. Would you like them to turn their minds to anything in the week ahead?
I think I'll turn to the call to action that we make in our book, which is that I think there are a lot of reasons to be concerned about the future that AI is, that we are collectively driving towards with AI. And there's also an opportunity for us to steer that future in a direction that's beneficial for all of us and for the public. There are discrete things that I think we can do to make this future better. I think a lot of people see irresponsible uses of AI in society, in government. You know, the United States, I think there's been a lot of deserved attention on the way that the Trump administration and DOGE has used AI in very visible ways. And we should resist those. We should call those out. But I think equally, we should not hesitate to push government to leverage AI in the places where it could make democracy and our lives as citizens of democracies better. You just gave some wonderful examples. I would add to that, language translation, I think, is one of the most, you know, already adopted and beneficial uses of AI, especially in very multilingual democracies like the United States. There should no longer be any excuse at all for governments not to serve people in a wide variety of languages. The barriers to that kind of translation are so much lower. Not to say that AI is perfect at doing that, but clearly government is so much more able to deliver those kinds of services in multiple languages than would have been possible in the past. And that's just one example. We try and go through many, many more in our book, calling out beneficial applications of AI for democracy, and we should push government to do that. And as we've discussed, we should also push for reform of the AI industry and the broader ecosystem of AI. It should not be left to those 150 proverbial white male American men in California to control and to generate all of the profit from. we call for AI to be brought more under public control and oversight, and for these technologies to be developed and steered by and for the benefit of the public. And I think that's something that's absolutely under the control of democracies to do, but we do have to make different choices, and we have to have more active public oversight of AI than we do today.
I would want people to really think big. A lot of the problems we're talking about here are not caused by AI, but they're exacerbated by AI. I mean, a lot of this is democracy and capitalism really struggling in the information age, right? These technologies were designed in the mid-1700s, and we could argue how well, but worked in the industrial age. And they're really straining in these decades. And to really imagine,
the aristocracy didn't survive the printing press. Will democracy right? survive the internet?
And that's a real question asked. And it's very hard for people, you know, in the water to imagine that the water would be different. But we need to. We need to really think about what these systems of organization, these methods of problem solving, I mean, that's what these systems are. I mean, how do we decide how many shoes to make or who gets to run the country or what to do? What systems are really work in an era of, you know, these, you know, very capable technologies and very fast communication and transportation and all of these things that are putting strains on both democracy and capitalism in these early decades of the 20th century. So I want people to think about that and not just assume that what we have is the pinnacle of human achievement, because it's really unlikely that it is.
That's a beautiful thought to end on. Can you plug your book one more time before I wrap up?
I can wave it around. It's actually not out yet. So this is like the secret advanced copy, Rewiring Democracy. And I will say very quickly, we have five parts to it. We talk about politics, legislating, government administration, the courts, and citizenship. How AI could affect all of those parts of democracy. And it's not about chatbots. It's not about deepfakes. It's about ways people, organizations are using technologies to make democracy more democratic.
Excellent. Well, even if it's not available right now, I've just put out my own book and I know how valuable pre-orders are. Where can people pre-order your book?
Everywhere fine books are sold.
Everywhere fine books are sold. Thank you so much for having tea with me, Bruce Shire and Nathan Sanders.
Well, our pleasure. Thank you for having us.